Bien, nous allons donc démarrer le séminaire qui aura lieu ce matin en anglais. So I'll switch to English to introduce Marco Baroni, who is giving us the pleasure of being here today. In fact, Marco is not coming from very far because he's working at Facebook, Facebook AI Research, which is a center in the north of Paris or center of Paris near the près de la Bourse. Beautiful center where there is a high concentration of bright young people trying to find new ways to introduce AI into computers, artificial intelligence in computers. Marco is a rather special person because he started as a pure researcher in theoretical linguistics. So he's a real linguist working at UCLA, and that's where he made his PhD. But then he switched to the industry, went back and forth between industry and research. I met Marco in Trento, where he was a researcher working with one of these prestigious ERC, European Research Council grants from Europe, and working for 5 years on the question of how to code for linguistic objects in neural networks. And I understand that this is still your topic of research. Very difficult question. It's not easy for neural networks to acquire something like language. And it is a very interesting open question for us, whether the models of neural networks can have a relevance for what is happening in the human brain. So we've been discussing together. We hope to do experiments together. So I'm very excited to have you here, Marco. Thank you very much for your being here.
Thank you. Is the microphone working?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, great. So thanks a lot. I'm very excited to be here. It's true that I come from near, but I had to traverse the Seine, which this morning looked quite scary. So I still think it's quite an achievement. I made it here. And it's actually like nice that Standahan talked earlier about comparative cognition between humans and animals, because I would also like to talk about comparative cognition, but this time between humans, or maybe humans and animals, and machines. In particular, I mean, if you follow like the press nowadays, there is a lot of excitement about this class of computational models called artificial neural networks that are apparently doing that are just like leading us to a lot of amazing progress. They are creating a lot of excitement. And so I would like to start my talk by introducing at a very high level what these artificial neural networks are and what they can do. I will then like zero in on one characteristic of human learning and human intelligence that I call systematic compositionality, which is actually sort of related to the topics that Professor De Haens talked earlier this morning about. And I will present some recent experiment in which we see whether, we try to test whether neural networks have this capacity for compositional learning that we think is very fundamental for humans. And if time allows, but I already pretty much know that it won't, I will also tell you a bit about some very recent research that we are doing in trying to make neural networks more compositional, because as we will see from the experiments, probably at the moment they aren't really able to do compositional learning. So artificial neural networks, what are they? Well, they are really a class of computer programs. Don't worry about this particular diagram, I've only put it there because it's cute. And by the way, they represent a very famous kind of neural network called convolutional neural networks that were developed by the boss of Facebook Artificial Intelligence, the Frenchman Yann LeCun, that I understand was also classmate of Standahan. And professor at Collège de France, small world. Anyway, artificial neural networks, as I was saying, basically are a form of computer programs that, like all computer programs, given a certain input, will generate an output. But the interesting thing is that unlike a standard computer program, where a programmer has to enter by hand the set of rules that will connect the input to the output, neural networks can actually learn this connection, learn to produce the right output given a certain input, just by looking at many examples of inputs and the associated outputs by extracting some kind of statistical regularities that they will find there. And let me also say here that like they are called neural networks because there are some superficial resemblances with the way in which neurons work, but this is really, really tenuous and you shouldn't make a big deal of them. They could have been called artificial pink elephants and maybe it would have been better because it would generate less confusion. So I'm speaking here of the second neural network coming because actually neural networks had been around for a while. They had sort of like a first phase of they saw a first phase of excitement in the 80s, early 90s. But really, they became like very central to what people are doing nowadays in artificial intelligence about 10 years ago. Well, maybe more like 6 or 7 years ago. Where they first made a splash in the ImageNet Visual Recognition Challenge. So in computer vision, like in many other fields of computer science, scientists like to measure progress by this shared campaign, some kind of like annual competition in which teams of researchers will present different systems that all try to solve the same task. And so we can like measure very objectively which system seems to be the best one at the current time. And one of the most challenging of these shared tasks in computer vision is the so-called ImageNet Visual Recognition Challenge, where a system has to recognize objects, so find the right object label, for objects that are contained in natural pictures. And so by natural pictures, I mean, you know, not some kind of schematic drawing of something, but really the kind of pictures that I or you might take with our cell phones. And these pictures contain objects that come, instances of objects that come from 1,000 categories, which mean that the distinction that you have to make are not only between, say, an elephant and a dog, but between an African elephant and an Indian elephant, or a Norfolk Terrier and a Yorkshire Terrier. Now, like in all kind of sort of fields of advanced science and technology, progress on this challenge in the early 2010s had been like quite slow. There were these systems that required really a lot of human knowledge in terms of what kind of visual features to use. And accuracy in 2011 was like at 74%, and it was kind of progressing every year, maybe of like 1%, where accuracy is just like the measure of how good the systems are at recognizing the objects in the images. And then in 2012, actually, Alex Krizhevsky, who at the time was a graduate student at the University of Toronto, who was not even an expert of computer vision, showed up with a system that was not one of these very complex hand engineering systems, but basically it was just a neural network just trained on examples of images and the corresponding labels. And there was just like a huge jump from 74% to 84% accuracy. And that was just something like unheard of. That doesn't happen. I think it never happened before, really, in this kind of competitions. And actually, like in a few years, neural network systems progressed to get an accuracy of about 93%, which arguably is more or less the level at which you will be able to categorize objects in these images if you were asked to. I certainly wouldn't distinguish a Norfolk Terrier from a Yorkshire Terrier. And notice that like there is something really amazing in this object recognition task because it is not something like, say, adding two numbers which we know a computer can do quite well and where we can specify explicit rules. Recognizing an object is the sort of kind of fuzzy prototype ability that we know we have, but as philosophers and psychologists have long noticed, we will be really hard-pressed to say, give exactly the definition of, say, what makes us recognize a dog in an image. What is exactly a dog? Indeed, for example, these are examples of pictures that a trained neural network correctly recognizes as instances of the category dog. And when you look at them, at best they have what Wittgenstein would call a family resemblance, right? I mean, okay, this maybe is a prototypical dog, but how about a dog drawing, a puppet of a dog in a mug? And still, neural networks, just from examples, are able to successfully address this task. The successes of neural networks didn't stop in image recognitions. A few years later, there was a paper in Nature where researchers at DeepMind, that is a company that was originally owned by Google, were able to teach neural networks to play old kind of 80s arcade games, the so-called Atari games, like Ping and similar games, were like video games, where like the interesting thing again was that like networks were basically playing these games just by, were just learning to play these games just by playing them, playing many games and eventually figuring out what to do. And in what is maybe, what has been maybe until now the most publicized success of neural networks. A few years ago, this also was reported in another Nature article and even in a feature movie. A team of researchers at DeepMind were able to train a neural network to play the game of Go, the ancient East Asian game of Go, at a level in which the network was actually able to beat one of the world champions of Go. And this was kind of huge, again, because these networks were really just like learning to play on their own. It was not just somebody writing down the rules. And because like Go is considered a game that has just like such a big complexity that people expected that for decades, complexity and also kind of rules that are sort of like intuitive, very difficult to formalize. And so people expected that it would take decades before before you could see a machine playing Go. And finally, and I think maybe most interestingly for us, given the topic of the seminar, neural networks nowadays also became the tool of choice to process language with computers. So for example, when you use the Google Translate system, what you have behind there, it is really a neural network which, say, can take a sentence in French and translate it often surprisingly well in the corresponding sentence in English. For example, here I didn't cheat. This is really what you get if you put the beginning of the research, if you type the beginning of the research into Google Translate. Now, I don't work for Google, so I cannot be entirely certain that they use neural networks here, although that's what they document. But for sure, I can tell you, for example, that the translation services of Facebook are nowadays entirely powered by neural networks. And at this point, you will comment, Facebook has translation services. And yes, it turns out that it does. It's like it's just an annoying feature by which sometimes it will like translate a post in a language that you speak into some kind of random words in another language. And that's what neural networks can do for you. So let's look at them a bit, just a bit more in detail. Essentially, a neural network, you can think of it really as some sort of sequence of mathematical equations, which will take as their input a very basic representation of the input at hand, for example, an image. They will have a set of weighted connections, basically a set of multiplication operations for each of the elements of the input, which will produce an inner representation of the input for the network, which basically is going to be just a list of real valued numbers, which then can be further transformed. For example, there can be multiple layers of these operations. Typically, there are other kind of mathematical transformations that are applied. And finally, this internal representation is converted into the output. So for example, in the case of artificial neural networks that do computer vision, the input is the image, which typically is going to be represented just, say, by the intensity values in each pixel of the image. Each of these pixels undergoes a set of arithmetic transformations, basically, in a series. And finally, at the last step, the network will produce an output which, for example, could be in a long index of possible categories, the index corresponding to the category Yorkshire Terrier. What is important is that there are by now well understood algorithms that allow you to train the network, as we say, to basically set its weights. If you think of the network as a set of equations, basically these will be the constants in the equations. You can learn to set these weights in order to produce the right output for each example input given a set of examples. So basically, each of these connections, and of course there are going to be many, many, many more of them, corresponds to one particular weight, one particular value that you want to multiply, for example, your input pixels by. At the beginning, these are going to be random, and then you show the network a lot of examples of an input and intended output, and eventually the network actually learns to set its weights in the correct way to be able to produce, given a certain input, the relevant output. One interesting aspect of all this is that inside the network, once you kind of do this kind of transformations, you get basically a vector, just like a list of numbers, that you can sort of like interpret as the distributed representation that the network created for a certain input. So here actually there is, I think, an interesting parallel with like the brain, because also the brain we know that represents things basically by patterns of activation, which are not unlike what neural networks are doing. And indeed, it is this possibility of learning its own representations, the fact that you just say give it raw images and the network will learn what to do with it, that make them so powerful. So the very same neural networks have been used, for example, as I already said, to label images with the objects they contain, but also they are fed, say, nowadays, newspaper documents, and they automatically categorize them as, I don't know, sports or politics or other topics, or in an interesting or a scary application, depending on your point of view, that recently was presented by Timnit Gebru, who at the time was at Stanford. They basically took Google Maps, Google Street View pictures of neighborhoods in America, and the networks will become able to predict whether people in that neighborhood voted for Republicans or Democrats. Which, you know, it's kind of, as I said, it's amazing, and maybe at the same time it's also a bit scary. Another very nice feature of neural networks is that, like all the applications I discussed about until now, they are great, but they all pertain really to having like one input at a time, let's say a picture, and producing the relevant output. If we think of living things that we would like to emulate with these systems, living things live in time, and so it is rarely the case that we only need to associate one thing with another without context. What is much more common, what happens, say, in language, what happens in moving around a city, what happens pretty much any time, is that we have a number of inputs over time, and we have to produce a number of output over time as well. It turns out that a relatively simple modification of a standard neural network can give us this kind of time-based contextual reasoning. So already in the early 90s, Jeff Ellman proposed the so-called recurrent neural networks, which are just like standard neural networks, but now in the input we provide to the network together with the external input, let's say a word, an image, what have you, also the state of the network itself at the previous time step. So I told you that the network produces these distributed representations. So when you are at time one, you are going to give to the network as input also its own, also the representation that the network provided at time zero. So if you look at this over time, this is the same network over time, you are going to have that like at each step in time, the network will produce an output which is a function of its own input at that time step, but also of the state of the network in the previous time step. And so these recurrent neural networks have been shown to be really powerful for things like language or playing video games, because through these recurrent connections, the network itself can really kind of like learn to preserve and use information over time and make choices at a certain time n based on the previous n minus one time steps. I don't know if maybe this will take me some time, but just for fun, one of the things that people have been doing with recurrent neural networks has been to just train them on corpora, on documents of a certain kind, and then let them generate more text of the same time. And a few years ago, Andrei Karpathy, who at the time was a graduate student at Stanford, just trained one of these recurrent networks by showing it basically the complete dramatic works of Shakespeare. So it just fed at each point in time to the network Shakespeare, asking it to produce the next word in each of the plays. And by the end, it will just like let the network generate Shakespeare, just freely produce words. And this is the sort of thing that the network will produce. So something like King Lear, oh, if you were a feeble sight, the courtesy of your law, your sight and several breath will wear the gods, and so on and so forth, which is total gibberish. It doesn't mean anything, but it sounds quite Shakespearean, doesn't it? I mean, even like the fact that the network, this is not something where, like, you know, Karpathy decided to, that this was King Lear. This was the network deciding to just write King Lear, colon. And maybe what is most amazing for me, I think that like some of the lines like this one are actually iambic pentameters, which is the meter in which Shakespeare wrote, which means that the network did learn something interesting about Shakespeare. And again, just like standard neural networks, because recurrent neural networks just learn by matching input sequences to output sequences, they can be used as is for a lot of things. Obviously language, so machine translation is typically done nowadays with recurrent neural networks. You feed English sentences and you get out French sentences. I will show a simple example later, give the network linguistic instructions and expect the network to navigate in a certain environment. In video games, maybe the input will be a sequence of video game states and the output will be the sequence of actions that the network will take. So I think things are indeed interesting, exciting, moving ahead fast. So are we about to finally build the sort of Terminator machines that are going to destroy humanity as a whole? And is that a good or a bad thing? But that's for another seminar, maybe more in a philosophy class. Well, it turns out that like, amazing as recurrent neural networks are, there is a problem with them. And this problem is that they are like very, very slow at learning. You can teach them almost everything, but you will need millions of examples of the thing you want to teach them, and typically also you are not going to be able to have them transferring knowledge from a task to something that is very similar. You can train a network to become the world champion of chess, but then that same network, if you want to train it to play checkers, will have to start from scratch. Actually, not unlike one of the apes, I think I, that Stan Dehan was talking about earlier today. So just to show like a concrete example of that, a few years ago, there was a paper by Brendan Lake and colleagues where they took one of these Atari games that I mentioned before from the Nature paper of DeepMind, so games in which that networks can become very good at playing. And then they took actually one of the co-authors in this paper, Josh Tenenbaum, that maybe some of you know. He had never played Frostbite, which is the game that we are showing the score for here. And basically, Josh Tenenbaum in 2 hours became very good at playing Frostbite, whereas like the network of the Nature paper, it took it something like 924 hours, which I think is several months, to get at the same level of playing Frostbite. So it looks like clearly there is a big difference here. And this is important, not only from an engineering point of view, it's not only annoying that you have to wait for months for the network to be able to do something, but I would argue also that this means that like we are still far from intelligence, from machine intelligence, because, I mean, I don't know how to define intelligence, but I'm pretty sure that one core aspect of it is our ability to adapt fast to new situations. It's like, you know, if I'm able to move around this room and then like later I have to go to the bathroom, you wouldn't have to show me 1 million times how to go to the bathroom if I already know how to navigate this room. And that really seems to be a property that these networks are missing, and one without which I think you cannot have intelligence. So what is the difference here? Well, I think that there are basically two aspects. One, which is huge, maybe it's the main one, is that when we say that humans or animals are fast at learning, typically we forget the fact that it took us millions of years of evolution to get at the point that we are at. So sure, we are, and also then typically, you know, years and years also of our own development. So sure, Josh Tenenbaum is fast at playing Frostbite, but that's because, you know, you have to consider all the time that, you know, between amoebas and Josh Tenenbaum and playing Frostbite, and then it's no longer that fast. The second aspect, which is the one I would like to focus on, is that we seem to have this property that when we find some new problem to solve, we don't just like solve it holistically and forget about it, but we are very good at kind of extracting a set of, a bag of tricks, if you want, like a set of basic abilities that then we recombine to solve new problems. So for example, going back to the Frostbite game, this is how it looks like. So speaking of like prior knowledge, in this Frostbite game, you have to jump from like plates of ice to plates of ice. You have to try to get into igloos and you have to avoid bears. And I suppose that Josh Tenenbaum already knew what bears are and that you should probably avoid them. He probably already knew that you cannot walk in water when he started playing this game, whereas a neural network is really more like, you know, it will be more like Josh Tenenbaum catapulted to another dimension where he cannot rely on the physics of our work anymore, he doesn't have the same perceptual channels anymore, and then probably it will be harder to learn to play Frostbite there. And concerning compositionality, well, for example, like whenever you play a video game, eventually you are going to learn a basic set of actions of things that you can do, such as jumping around things or maybe facing them with some weapon. And once you have these skills, you can very much extend it to any new creature that appears, or even, for example, from one video game to the other. This is the ability that I called compositionality, and I would like to focus a bit more on that because, like, Of course, prior knowledge is a very important aspect. As I said, maybe it is the fundamental aspect, but there we are pretty sure that current neural networks don't have prior knowledge. We know that because basically we code them and we know that they don't contain it. But there is an open question of whether they are able to apply compositionality in their learning or not. And just kind of like a neat example from a paper of a few years ago by Piantadosi and Aslin of just how compositional we human beings are, they took four-month-olds, so, you know, these are like really little things, and they trained them at the following task. They would see tracks that had colors and patterns on their side. Then these tracks would go behind a screen, and something will happen. For example, if a track went behind a red screen, the track will become red. And during the training phase, children were only shown what happened when the track was going behind a single screen. That's all they saw. And then in a test phase, in which there was no further kind of learning episodes, suddenly the children were shown a track that was going under two screens. And for example, in this case, the track would first go, let's say that it was a blue track, it would go behind the blue screen and stay blue, but then going behind the red screen, it will become red. And it turns out that the children, I mean, they were not perfect at this, but they were definitely way above chance in their performance, which shows that even 4 month olds, of course we still don't know whether by nature or by nurture, have a strong tendency to just combine skills that they have acquired in new ways. So for example, only seeing tracks that go behind single screens, but then very quickly find out what will happen if the track was going behind two screens. So all this is what I define compositionality. Now I would like to, what I define as compositionality. Now I would like to focus on a particular kind of compositionality, which arguably is the most striking one, which is something that I think Jerry Fodor originally named systematic compositionality. Zenon Pilishin and Gary Marcus are other people that have studied this property quite extensively, exactly in relation to computational models that learn from data. So the idea of systematic compositionality is that apparently as humans, when we are faced with some kind of experience, we tend to extract general rules, and these rules contain variables, which in turn could be filled by the output of another rule, which makes us able to generalize very fast. I think this is clearer with an example. Suppose that I am teaching you about some mysterious language that looks suspiciously like English, and I teach you that to walk is to do this activity, and that to walk twice is to walk once, and then to walk twice, the same with running, and then with running twice, and running three times. And let's see that at this point, I'm running once, just to go back to my computer. I tell you that nowadays, the young cool kids, they have this new way to salute each other, which is to dax. And dax consists in kind of touching the tips of your finger behind your shoulder, let's say. Now, if you learn about daxing, and now I ask you to dax twice, do you want to try? Okay, you don't because you are shy, but I think we all agree that daxing twice would be something of the sort. And why are we able to do that? And we can even dax three times, I mean, if our shoulders allow us to do that. A reasonable theory is because when we were looking at those, when we were learning about walking and twice and so on, we extracted some kind of rule. I mean, I'm not sure that these are the right rules, but just to give you an idea, rules of this sort. So let's say that here X stands for some kind of arbitrary input variable, and that the double square brackets stand for the meaning of. We kind of learn a rule such as that to the meaning of to x twice is the meaning of X, and then again the meaning of X. And then if we have this kind of rules, and later we learn that the meaning of DAX is to perform the DAXing action, at that point, by putting together rule 1 and rule 3, when we encounter DAX twice, we can immediately see that to DAX twice means to DAX and then to DAX again. And that's why we are super fast at generalizing. And indeed, we can do something even more amazing. If at that point I tell you to DAX twice, three times, you may think that this is a bit of a silly way to ask you to do that, but you probably understand that that means that I'm asking you to DAX six times, and I could probably go on ad libitum and asking you to DAX time, three times, twice, three times. It gets very confusing, but I think you at least get the gist of what I'm trying to instruct you to do there. And again, why can we do that? Well, we can do that because DAX twice, three times will match the template of the second rule there. So I have DAX twice, which is a composed expression, but that I can put in that slot for X over there. And then I get that DAX twice, three times means DAX twice, DAX twice, DAX twice. And then I apply the first rule, and for each of the DAX twice, I replace it with DAX DAX, and finally I end up with six applications of this, the meaning of operator to DAX, which tells me to DAX six times, which shows that with very finite means, I can really generalize a lot. So let me now go a bit to the empirical part, otherwise I'm not really going to get there. With Brendan Lake, we wonder whether neural networks could also be trained to do the same. And in order to test this, we designed a very simple environment in which a network was given a set of commands like the one we just saw, so things like walk and turn left, and the network had to produce a set of actions. So for example, in the case of walk and turn left, the network had to produce a walk action. These were just like a symbol. It's not like we were implementing a robot or anything. The walk action followed by an L turn action that will make it turn left. Now, crucially, what we did is we tested only generalization. So at training time, the network will be shown lots of examples, 100,000, as a matter of fact, of orders, instructions with the corresponding action. So jump after walk means action walk, action jump. Walk and turn left means walk followed by L turn, and so on and so forth. Lots and lots of these examples. And then at test time, we would ask the network to follow the instruction jump around and turn left, which was an instruction that the network had not seen until that point. Now, interestingly, this was just like a standard recurrent neural network of the sort that nowadays are used, for example, for machine translation. In a first experiment, we looked at whether the network could generalize at all by splitting the possible commands randomly into training commands and testing commands. So, for example, in one of these experiments, at test time, the network was presented the new command, look around left twice and jump right twice. This was new, but during training, the network had already seen look around left twice, it had already seen jump right twice, and it had even already seen look around left twice and it also had already seen and jump right twice. Well, in this kind of scenario, it turns out that the network is very good at generalizing to new commands. So here in these graphs, you see on the x-axis how many commands were used in the training phases, how many distinct commands the network saw of the overall set during training. And on the y-axis, you have the accuracy of new commands, which is basically the proportion of test commands that the network was able to guess at the first trial. Well, we see that like even when the proportion is actually quite unbalanced, the network sees only 8% of the commands during training and has to generalize to the remaining 92% of commands, generalization is perfect. The network can really generalize. However, here we are not really sure if this is a systematic sort of generalization. So when we go looking at the examples that we have in this kind of data set, we observe that it's really more of kind of like a mix and could be that just some kind of like, you know, mix and match chunking strategy, recognizing pieces that the network has already seen, might actually suffice to support generalization. So next, we tried a more systematic way to test the nature of the generalization of the network. And if you think of systematic compositionality, one of the things that it allows us to do, like in my silly ducks twice, three times, four times example, is to generalize to longer sequences when I have only seen shorter ones. And so, for example, in the case of our experiment, if I know the meaning, let's say, of jump twice, I know the meaning of run twice, and I know the meaning of end, that means that I also know the meaning of jump twice and run twice, and I can understand that sequence, even if it may be longer than anything that I've heard before. And so we tested the network in a setup in which during training, the network was seen only commands that were like corresponding to actions up to a certain length, a length of 22 actions. And then at test time, the commands were such that they would require action sequences of at least 24 actions. There is not 23 there just because the nature of this environment is such that there are no commands that require 23 actions. And what we see now is a very different picture. So here you have again accuracy on the y-axis, but now on the x-axis you see the performance of the network for test commands of different action length. And so what we see here is that, okay, the network is already not doing that well when it has to generalize to 24 actions, to 25 actions, it gets even worse. But then after that, basically, the network is just like at 0% accuracy. And this seems to be something very non-human-like, because I am also sure that if we did this experiment with people, the longer the sequence, the more likely it is that you are also going to make mistakes, of course, but it's very unlikely that we will be observing just this very kind of sharp pattern where just at a certain point, catastrophically, the network fails to generalize. And finally, we also ran the DAX experiment that I showed at the beginning, but let me tell you of a variant of that we did in machine translation. So this is just a bit of like a proof of concept thing. So we hypothesized that one of the reasons why current neural networks need so much training data is because they don't generalize systematically, but they generalize into sort of like mix and match way that we saw in experiment one, where you find something that is similar enough to your current test case in the training data, and you just minimally generalize from there. And if you have to do that, it means that you need a huge database of training examples to do this, which means that you are going to be slow to generalize. So to test this in machine translation, given that machine translation is one of the things that these systems do very well, we used a corpus, we trained the network on a corpus of translations from English to French, in which we made up a new adjective, daxi, which will be translated in French as daxiste. During the training time, the network will see a lot of sentences that will exemplify constructions with predicate in English and French. So, you know, I am X translated as je suis X, and so on and so forth, for many, many adjectives, many nouns, and so forth. And also, it saw many times the particular translation, I am Daxi, je suis Daxiste. And then at test time, the network had to generalize to the other forms of the Daxiste paradigm. So you are Daxi to a Daxiste, il est daxiste, and so on and so forth. Il est très daxiste. Where like the networks, they had seen many examples of he is very X, il est très X, or Y, but it had never seen this particular example. And as you might expect from what I've told you until now, it turns out that, again, the network is really not able to generalize us in these cases, and of eight test instances from the DAXI paradigm, it was able to get only one right. So, coming to my conclusion, what we are seeing nowadays is that, well, first of all, neural networks are amazing and they can do things that just a few years ago we didn't think you could just do with learning systems. Their beauty in particular is what people call this end-to-end property, that you basically just feed it examples of the input and the output you want and they will learn from that. And it is also true that the kind of learning they do does involve some kind of generalization. That was shown in our first experiment where we just split randomly our do this and do that twice commands. And of course it is also implicitly shown by the fact that say these networks will be able to recognize new dog pictures, they will be able to translate new sentences into a language. And however, our evidence suggests that these networks, even when they generalize, they are not really extracting systematic generalization rules such that then they could be immediately able to just produce or understand a huge, maybe even infinite number of new structures. And so in our current work, in our lab, what we are trying to do is to see whether we can actually get neural networks to become more compositional. And there are like actually ideas about how to do that, which involve just trying to ingest a lot of kind of manual knowledge, a lot of rules into these systems. Interesting research, but the problem there is that we are going to just lose the generality that they have. We may end up having a system that works very well for a certain problem, but then it will not really be able to learn about new problems. And so the kind of approach that we are looking into is actually going back to this idea that like the reason why we humans and presumably other animals are so compositional is because we don't have just to learn about one single task. It's not that like playing Go is all we have to do in our life, but we have to do just like a huge number of different things. And so it is very important for us to learn and adapt fast. And so what we are doing is we are running simulations in which we have actually plain recurrent neural networks with no kind of modification, but we try to train them to really try to do a number of different things where then like generalization becomes very important. And of course that leads to some pretty difficult questions like how do you exactly, you know, simulate the history, you know, of humanity? How do you have an environment that simulates, you know, the one that led from amoebas to Josh Tenenbaum playing Frostbite, which is a pretty good problem. And then the other problem is that I think from amoebas to Josh Tenenbaum, I'm pretty sure it's a few hundred million years at least. And you know, even with modern machines, we cannot really wait a few million years before we develop the ultimate Terminator machine. And I think with that, I would like to conclude my talk.